Hello, my name is Poe Johnson. I am a PhD student here at the University of Texas at Dallas, and today I am with
Sophia Roost.
And can you tell us a little bit about yourself before we begin?
Sure. I'm a professor of the history of science at Harvard University. Before that, I was in the Pembroke Center for Teaching and Research on Women at Brown University, and my degree is in history, anthropology, and science, technology, and society from MIT.
Okay, that's rather all very impressive. You have a book coming out, and that book is called
Synthetic: How Life Got Made.
And can you tell us a little bit about that, a synopsis perhaps?
Sure. So the book is based on 8 years of fieldwork that I did among synthetic biologists, which is a subdiscipline of the life sciences that coalesced in the first few years of the 21st century. So the field brought together mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, chemical engineers, and computer scientists who all decided that they wanted to attempt to study life and to learn more about how life works by making new living things from scratch. And this is a really strange turn for biology, which has traditionally been experimental science or field science. And I was really curious as to how a discipline decides to embark on manufacture as a form of knowledge production or as a kind of inquiry. And I began tracking these researchers in 2005 and tried to understand how their theories about life got embedded into the new living things that they built, stuff like microbes or viruses.
Okay, so did you find that while you were researching these people as they were doing their experiments and as they were constructing and manufacturing life, that they themselves had different ideas about what constituted life? What I mean to say is that did they think unilaterally, okay, this is what life is and this is what we are then creating? Or did they have different ideas of where life began or how life began or what constituted sort of a life once it actually existed?
They absolutely had different ideas about what life was. Like I said, because they came from different disciplines, many of them hadn't been trained in experimental biology. They hadn't been in a wet lab before. And some people, especially those from mechanical engineering, thought about life in really mechanistic terms. So one researcher once asked me a rhetorical question: what's the difference between designing a bridge and designing a genome? The premise there being that there is no difference. Whereas other people who had been trained in biology or had spent more time in a lab, in particular people coming from chemical engineering or just biology more simply, had a sense of organisms as being more resistant, being more agential, being messier. And that ended up affecting the way they thought about how to design an experiment, how to design an organism, and what kinds of expectations they had about what they could make and whether it would work or not.
So for a lot of people, I think when they hear about scientists creating life, there's a sort of like this crazy mad scientist stereotype that's in their head where this person is trying to like take over the world or destroy the planet or something. Or just like, not even if it's that intentional, just that their inquiry ends up being devastational to the rest of the world, right? So how are these actual experiments different for them? And how did the sort of the scientists who actually worked on these things, how did they actually come about this methodologically, maybe even philosophically, as a differently than how maybe the normal general public would think of it?
Do you mean why did they not think they were going to destroy the world?
Well,
is
no,
that the question?
Not just why did they not think they were going to destroy the world, but how did, what were their intentions? What were the assumptions that they were coming up with as to how they got from X to Z, right? So how did they think, okay, we're going to create life? And what did that mean for them?
Well, the first thing I should say is, I'll tell you a story. This was a few months into my field work. So I'd been going to lab meetings at a lab at MIT once a week. And there was a new grad student, so his first year in the department, and he was giving his first presentation to the lab, very nervous. And he started a sentence by saying, what the PI is an abbreviation for principal investigator, the head of the lab. Well, what the PI did when he created this virus, and all of a sudden the entire room stopped. Everyone had been having side conversations and snacking, and it just shut down the conversation entirely. And the PI corrected him after a few seconds, and he said, we don't create life, we construct it. And it was an interesting moment in which this student was being trained in the correct wording to use to describe the work that they were doing. And I became really curious as to why it was so important to not talk about creating. And one of the things that happened to be going on around the same time was a series of legal decisions regarding intelligent design and creationism and whether it would be taught in school districts, so the Dover case. And because of that, a lot of people were really anxious that synthetic biology would in some ways give more ammunition to creationists by the reasoning that if life is so hard to make, then it does require an intelligent designer, whether the intelligent designer is the engineer or the engineer with a capital E, right? So there were all sorts of religious connotations that got built into the work they were doing, going back to your question about playing God. And another synthetic biologist, actually, this is quite famous, so I can just tell you, was Craig Venter. When he engineered what was called Cynthia, which was a synthetic mycoplasma, a lot of people said to one of his researchers, Ham Smith, that they were being accused of playing God. And Smith's response was, "We don't play," right? So, which is kind of an obnoxious response, but his point was that he kind of embraced the notion that what he was doing was godlike. And was willing to go with that rather than distance himself in the way that the MIT scientist did.
Okay, so as someone who did an ethnography on these groups, how did that kind of attitude play out in the actual work being done? So was it sort of this hyper-aggressive sort of, I don't want to say macho, but machismo kind of attitude where people are like, I'm playing God? Or was it something that is sort of more akin to perhaps holistic in that people were not nearly as sort of overtly obnoxious about it, I don't want to sort of use those terms, but that they were more considerate about what they were doing in a public sense, that they weren't just thinking about this, I want to do this because I can, but I want to do this because it actually has value to the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on what you mean by value. And the first thing I should say is I don't want to make any broad claims about all synthetic biologists. As an anthropologist, I very quickly learned to be tuned into the ways in which communities are not monolithic. And so different people approach what they were doing in different ways, and they thought about it quite differently. Most of them got into the field because either they were interested in understanding life better, or they were interested in finding ways to make useful things using living substance. So one of the earliest examples of a successful synthetic biology project was the work of Jay Kiesling. He was able to synthesize an anti-malarial compound called artemisinin and then freely licensed it so that it would be much more, much cheaper and then made available to the developing world, although that hasn't actually happened yet, which is a longer story. But so there's a very instrumental reason for why they're doing what they're doing. There's a much more epistemologically driven question about life as this thing that they want to better understand. So this is more of scientific inquiry. Very few of them, I think, were in it for, you know, hubristic reasons.
Okay, so taking that kind of notion of the sort of the free, how would you sort of characterize, I don't want to say you can characterize all of them as you just said, but how would you sort of characterize the environment of these particular laboratories? Are they more interested in, again, like serving a public need, or they're just interested in kind of serving an intellectual one? What do you sort of think of them, and how would you analyze them after the fact? So what would you think is their kind of main priority?
Well, I've seen both priorities. Broadly speaking, academic labs tend to be more interested in questions about life and knowledge of life. Obviously, labs in companies are going to be in it for money, and they might have really good intentions behind what they do, but as companies, you know, their first priority is making money. So you know, some of the labs I went to were, you know, huge corporations that were working on things like biofuels, synthesizing drugs, stuff like that. And others were doing much more bespoke, almost artisanal projects where they were taking a single organism and trying to modify it to make it simpler, more understandable, more aesthetically pleasing, things like that.
So for your own purposes, for your own book, when you're doing this research, I don't want to say which one is easier, but which one is sort of more available in terms of your own intellectual work? So which one did you find to be more accessible? Maybe that's a better term.
Which kind of group, lab?
Yes, which kind of lab?
academic labs are always easier to get access to. Just because as an academic, people are more open to having fellow academics walk into their lab. They're less likely to have proprietary reasons to not want you around. But I also had great luck with some of the corporate labs and in particular startups. And one of the ways to get access to those kinds of places is by going to conferences and just meeting people in a really informal way and then asking them more about their work and then, you know, very slowly finding a way to get access to places that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get to.
Okay, I think that's actually it for today. I think we're out of time. I want to thank you again for joining us. And this is Poe Johnson signing off. Goodbye.